Day 18 of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, Russian forces have advanced closer to the capital Kiev from the north, west, and northeast and destroyed airports in the town of Vasilkiv. German Chancellor and the French President have called for an immediate ceasefire in Ukraine during phone calls with the Russian President Vladimir Putin. And multiple rockets target a base hosting American troops and two Israeli Mossad training centers in the northern Iraqi city of Erbil. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. It's now 18th day of Russia's offensive on Ukraine. Air raid sirens and shelling have been ringing out throughout the beleaguered country as Russian forces are gaining ground around the capital, Kiev. Russian forces have advanced even closer to the capital from the north, west, and northeast. Russian strikes have also destroyed an airport in the town of Vasilkiv, south of the capital. Elsewhere in Ukraine, the besieged northern city of Chernihiv has come under intense shelling. New artillery and air attacks have also been reported in several other cities. In the south, the port city of Mykolaiv is also under heavy bombardment. Ukrainian officials say a mosque has been shelled in the besieged city of Mariupol. Kiev has for the first time given a toll to the country's forces.
People are being killed. We're not happy that we have lost some 1,300 soldiers and Russia has lost about 12,000, 1 to 10. It doesn't give me joy that they have lost 12,000. It doesn't make me happy. This is not the way I see the world.
Ukrainian officials say the country is facing a humanitarian crisis and needs food as well as medicine. They also said that heavy shelling and threats of Russian air attacks are endangering attempted evacuations of civilians from encircled towns and cities. So far, nearly 2.6 million people, most of them women and children, have fled Ukraine for neighboring countries. As the offensive intensifies in Ukraine, one story has been discovered by our correspondent in Poland. Robert Carter has met a Russian living in Poland who is helping a Ukrainian family who fled the war.
As the vicious war in Ukraine rages on, refugees struggle to find somewhere, anywhere, safe to stay. The dominant media narratives are heavily focused on Russians and Ukrainians fighting each other. But here in Poland, Press TV found a unique exception. Meet Svetlana, a Ukrainian mother who fled Kyiv with her two children, Dmytro and Ksenia. They have been taken in by a native Russian who lives in Lublin with his Polish wife.
For me, it wasn't even choice. I just started to write to my friends in the messengers and suggest them help or hosting, and I think it's the only choice I had. I feel angry that I can't stop it, I can't help.
Svetlana was forced to flee as the fighting surrounded the city. Her family have endured a 630-kilometer journey through the freezing cold. She tells us the ordeal has been traumatizing.
After the war started, it was a great fear that hit us. The first thing I did was turn on the news. Then I collected just three suitcases and suddenly we had to run. We didn't know what to pack, what to eat, what medicine to bring, how will we cook, and what about school. To be honest, to be less stressed, I just turned off my feelings. If I had time to think about all the danger, I'd probably go crazy. The journey we had to deal with and the uncertainty. It was physically very hard, and I was only allowed to relax and cry once we escaped.
Poland has become a beacon of sanctuary for many refugees, with some 1.5 million already entered the country and many more on the way.
Unfortunately, the refugee crisis has now become heavily politicized, specifically in the English-speaking world. But behind those headlines are just ordinary people trying to get by. Regardless of whether they speak Russian, Ukrainian or Polish, the civilians all ultimately want the same thing, regardless of where they come from. An end to the war. Robert Carter, Lublin.
France and Germany have renewed calls on Russia for a ceasefire in Ukraine and a diplomatic solution to this conflict. In a conference phone call, the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and French President Emmanuel Macron called on the Russian President Vladimir Putin to lift a days-long siege of the Ukrainian city of Mariupol. Macron referred to allegations of rights abuses by Russian soldiers, warning that they may amount to war crimes. Over the past days, diplomatic efforts by world leaders to end this conflict have made no progress. Kiev says it remains open to diplomacy, but will not give in to ultimatums.
Of course, this doesn't exclude the track of diplomacy and the need to talk and to find solutions. But as President Zelensky said on a number of occasions, we are ready to negotiate, but we are not going to accept any ultimatums and surrender.
The Ukrainian foreign minister added that if his country had more fighter jets, it would have been able to save more civilian lives by targeting Russian military convoys. He explained the main striking force of Russia is in the air. The U.S. President Joe Biden has authorized an additional $200 million worth of weaponry and assistance to Ukraine. This is while Russia has warned that Western supplies of weapons to the country are legitimate targets for its troops. And now joining us for shed light, more light on the Ukrainian conflict is Lawrence Davison, former lecturer out of Westchester University, Westchester, Pennsylvania. Professor Lawrence Davison, always a pleasure to check in with you, sir. Okay, day 18, your thoughts on where we stand so far, efforts to try to get some ceasefire going and some more diplomacy involved, and the refugee influx. Estimated, Larry, up to 4 million refugees. I think we're around 2 point something right now, but 4 million refugees in total are about to flee Ukraine in total in the few days to come.
Yeah, and that doesn't even account for the fact that the Russians haven't pushed really into Western Ukraine yet. If they do, that will ratchet up the refugee numbers. I think that the Russians are following their own timeline here. I'm skeptical of reports that say the Ukrainians, are slowing them down and holding them up. I'm sure there's intense fighting and all, but I think that the Russians are playing to their own timeline. They have particular targets. I'm sure they want to take Kiev, and I think they want to take Mariupol. Is that the name of the city in the east? Because it's the headquarters of a sort of Nazi army division of the Ukrainian army. I don't see any immediate prospect of a diplomatic settlement. And that's a real shame. I mean, Zelensky, the president in Kiev, seems to, in my opinion, seems to have a real martyr complex. I mean, you know, he's going to go down with the ship, and he's sort of making sure that the ship does go down.
All right, Larry, always a pleasure to check in with you. Stay safe, pal. Joining us, Lawrence Davison there, former lecturer from Westchester, Pennsylvania. And now, Iraqi media says a number of explosions have been heard in the city of Erbil in the country's region of Kurdistan. The media cited local officials saying multiple rockets have hit U.S. military bases in the area. There are also reports suggesting that Washington's new consulate building and two advanced Israeli Mossad training centers in Erbil have come under rocket attacks. Now, security forces are on high alert, and roads to Erbil Airport have been closed. Alarm sirens have also been activated in the U.S. Embassy inside the highly secured green zone of the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. U.S. officials say there have been no casualties. Attacks are the latest in a series of such strikes targeting U.S. interests in Iraq. Joining us now from Toronto, Canada, is Eric Wahlberg, author and journalist, for more on the story. Hello, Eric. Hope you're safe and doing well. These attacks, whether it's U.S. Military convoys on the roads, bases, frequent attacks over the last couple of years. Why do you think it's the case, Eric? Eric Wahlberg, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, good. I was putting my first question to you. We're talking about Iraq, obviously. U.S. interests have been suffering quite a bit of attacks on Iraqi soil over the last couple of years. What are your thoughts on why and the ramifications of these attacks?
Well, I don't even know if there's been any clear evidence of who does most of the attacks. So I haven't any real, I can't say that, point fingers at anyone, but I mean, it's a boiling kettle, and it's going to have flashes of boiling over, and it's a bit chaotic. The whole Middle East is becoming more and more chaotic. And if this is true, that this base that in Erbil was is an Israeli-sponsored training center, that would be quite a big earthquake. I really don't know what the ramifications. I have to think about it. It's certainly not good for the U.S. I can say that. I don't know if it's good for anybody. But,
I mean, Eric, but you know, Iraq is kind of it's a special case. When you look at the Middle East, there's a lot going on in Syria and Afghanistan. Stories and narratives are completely different. When it comes to Iraq, there was a fake pretext. You remember weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein is a dictator. We have to get him out of office. They go in there. They hang the guy. In 2 weeks, Saddam is gone. But the U.S. stayed there for nearly 20 years. They brought so much instability into the country that Daesh terrorist group emerged. And then after they killed Iran's top military commander, Sayyidullah Soleimani, you very well know Iraqi parliament voted for U.S. forces to leave. And they said they will, but they're still there. Why?
Well, and there are, I think it's 50 bases actually in Iraq, scattered where strategically. And so it's not a huge force. I don't know if it's 3,000 troops or 5,000, I can't remember, but they don't seem to be going anywhere. That Iraqi parliament tried, and it was just brushed aside. So we know who is really controlling still going on in Iraq, but it's getting out of control. And if this Israeli connection comes out, that will really that's a spark that will really ignite the anti-Israeli sentiment. It's going to just galvanize.
All right, pal. Stay safe, and thanks for joining us from Toronto, Canada. That was Eric Wahlberg there joining us. And now Oil Minister Javad Oji says that Iran has managed to defeat a U.S. campaign to push a country's oil income to zero. The minister says Iran's collected revenue from the sales of oil, natural gas, and petrochemical products has increased by 150% in the current Iranian year, which ends March 20th. He cites a new greater marketing efforts and various contracting techniques as a reason for the boost in Iran's revenues. OG denies speculations that the U.S. has lessened its pressure to curb Iran's oil revenues amid efforts to revive the JCPOA. He says the U.S. has in fact greatly increased its efforts to hamper Iranian oil exports in recent months. The Iranian minister says the U.S. campaign is no longer limited to punitive measures against Iran's clients. Washington has repeatedly moved to seize Iranian oil shipments. OG's comments follow Western media reports that the U.S. seized a cargo of two tankers carrying Iranian crude a while back. Now, the issue of human rights has always been a major concern in the international community, with some countries blaming others for not implementing their obligations. Iran says it has always been against double standards when it comes to human rights issues.
And the second issue that we are following it up at the level of international organizations dealing with the human rights is the issue of avoiding double standard and selective approaches. Human rights is human rights. And if it is violated, it is bad everywhere. Either it is in Iran or it is in other countries. We do not have bad or good violation of human rights. But what we are witnessing is a political approach toward the human rights.
Qadi Babadi made the comments in an exclusive interview. He said some countries use human rights as a political tool against others to achieve their goals. The Iranian official added there are countries that have not held even one single election in their political lifetime, but are still immune from criticism in international organizations. Ghadi Babadi reminded the fact that Tehran is a permanent member of several important international human rights treaties and is implementing its obligations under those accords. An exhibition is open in the Yemeni capital Sana'a to introduce part of crimes and violations committed by the Saudi-led coalition during 7 years of its war and siege. The exhibition has been organized by students at Sana'a University. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports.
To remind the world of years of bloodshed and destruction by a Saudi-led coalition in Yemen, Sana'a University has hosted an exhibition displaying drawings and photos of the war with subtitles in different languages, including Persian. During the inauguration ceremony, organizers praised the role of resistance media outlets, including Press TV, in supporting the Yemeni people and exposing the crimes being committed against civilians by the Saudi-led coalition.
We really thank Press for coming today. They're debating really a good thing. They're representing us in the Western countries, to the European countries, and also and we just come to the reality that we're really besieged. Through military stuff, through media.
Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed and millions of others have been suffering from the Saudi-led war and siege since 2015. Unfortunately, the mainstream Western media keep turning a blind eye to the crimes and violations against Yemenis. Despite the wounds inflicted by years of the Saudi-led war, this exhibition proves that art and creativity are still alive in Yemen. Organizers say the exhibition gives a clear idea of suffering millions of Yemenis have endured. It is also an attempt to revive the conscience of the world, which has seemingly died along with hundreds of thousands of innocent Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In a report presented to the United Nations Human Rights Council recently, David Boyd, the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and the Environment, says pollution contributed to twice as many premature deaths as COVID-19 in the first 18 months of the coronavirus pandemic. We now present you an article written by Damien Gale. The piece is titled, UN Expert Warns Millions Suffering in Deadly Pollution Sacrifice Zones. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. A United Nations expert has warned of the creation of pollution sacrifice zones across the world, where tens of millions of people are suffering strokes, cancers, respiratory problems and heart disease as a result of toxic contamination of the environment. David Boyd, a United Nations expert, told The Guardian, "There are sacrifice zones all over the world, in every region, in the north, in the south, in the east and the west, in rich countries and in poor countries." David Boyd, the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and the Environment, cited physical health issues, including cancer, heart disease, respiratory illness, strokes, and reproductive health problems, as well as incredible mental health problems associated with living in these places, because people feel exploited and they feel stigmatized. David Boyd said, "All of this infringed their human rights, their rights to life and their rights to health, and their right to a clean, healthy and sustainable environment." He added, "You cannot reconcile that fundamental right to a healthy environment with these absolutely horrific environmental conditions." In a report presented to the United Nations Human Rights Council recently, David Boyd says pollution contributed to twice as many premature deaths as COVID-19 pandemic in the first 18 months of the pandemic. Giving the death toll from pollution in that period is a staggering 9 million people, the report adds. One in six deaths in the world involves diseases caused by pollution, three times more than deaths from AIDS, malaria and tuberculosis combined, and 15 times more than from all wars, murders and other forms of violence. David Boyd's report warns the toxification of planet Earth is intensifying, pointing out that even as some harmful chemicals are banned or abandoned, overall production of chemicals doubled between 2000 and 2017 and will double again by 2030. And while everyone was affected to some degree, some communities were being hit far more than others. David Boyd told The Guardian, "If you look at these places that I've highlighted in my report, pollution on our planet today is pervasive. It's affecting everyone, but it's affecting some people in a really grossly unfair and disproportionate way." He said, "The United States, one of the wealthiest countries in the world, one of the wealthiest countries in all of human history, is home to one of the worst sacrifice zones on the planet. This place, it's called Cancer Alley, in Louisiana, where there are more than 100 oil refineries, petrochemical plants, etc." David Boyd added, "And guess where they're located? In poor, predominantly black communities in Louisiana. It's just as I said, it's unconscionable." Other sacrifice zones include Kabwe in Zambia, where 95% of children had elevated levels of lead in their blood, putting them at risk of lifelong intellectual impairment. The Patarat landfill in Romania, where thousands of Roma people live and are exposed to arsenic, lead, mercury and other pollutants. The French overseas territories of Guadeloupe and Martinique in the Caribbean, where 90% of people were found to have the carcinogenic pesticide chlorodicone in their blood. David Boyd said businesses were the main culprit, with most happy to overlook social and environmental costs in favour of their bottom line, adding that money was the main barrier to addressing the climate crisis, to addressing biodiversity loss, and to addressing pervasive pollution. He called on governments around the world to impose strong regulation on corporations causing pollution and to stop spending an estimated $1.8 trillion a year on subsidies for environmentally damaging industries. David Boyd said oil and gas companies are not going to voluntarily stop producing oil and gas. Big coal companies are not going to voluntarily shift from being big coal companies to being big solar and wind companies. Governments have to do that. That's their job. It's governments that have the obligations to respect, to protect and fulfill our human rights. But he said there was cause for optimism. David Boyd's report comes 6 months after the Human Rights Council recognized for the first time that everyone had a human right to live in a clean, healthy and sustainable environment. He said, and this is really a key point, previous agreements on biodiversity and climate change and pollution were formally unenforceable. But guess what? When you weld the international environmental agreements together with human rights law brings into the equation institutions, processes and accountability. David Boyd added, that's what's really exciting about this United Nations recognition of a right to a clean, healthy and sustainable environment. It signals this union of human rights law and environmental law, which can be an extremely powerful catalyst of the kinds of transformative changes that we so desperately need.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Muhsin. Sayyid Muhsin, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
And Sayyid Murtaza, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
So today, when you look at the media all around the world, a type of harsh, violent, barbaric picture is made out of the religion of Islam, especially with the creation of such groups like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and the suicide bombing, you know, here and there. Especially the people in the West has a wrong view regarding the religion of Islam and the true teachings of Islam. Today we want to talk about this topic, how the religion of Islam can help international bodies to establish peace all around the world. Sayyid Murtaza, let's start with you, brother. Islam is really a peaceful religion, isn't it?
Well, thank you very much. If you look at the word Islam itself, it has its deep root in peace and comfort. So these days, we know that peacekeeping is a very essential and important part of everybody's life. I mean, the whole humanity needs to take refuge to peacekeeping. Otherwise, the same skirmish that we can see around the world is happening.
That's right.
And unfortunately, conflict and fights, have taken over, you know, to many parts of the world, even very small communities around the world. So, unfortunately, some biased medias, are trying to instill this wrong idea that religious conflict is the root of all these problems around the world. And we know that it has become a very important issue these days. Okay. So the religion of Islam is very much interested and even is trying to disseminate this true ideology that peace and religion are together. So any religion who's trying to propagate conflict, discomfort and problems is not actually a true religion. So
that's right.
Islam is telling us that peacekeeping or keeping peace among all humanity is very essential and is necessary.
Okay, and there have been so many conversions to the religion of Islam because of the peace that it brings into the society and also at the individual mental level. You know, the people was converted, when you ask them, one of the reasons is this tranquility, calmness, and peace of mind that it brings to you. This is one individual aspect, but when you look at the societal, social, collective aspect, you can find also this kind of peace. Said Mohsen, what's your comment on that, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, first of all, we should know that that the religion has a strong influence on the people.
Yes.
In belief and in their faith. So, and we know that the people, they cannot live without having a belief or faith. Even the atheists do have a belief on which they obviously rely. Therefore, we see different religions in the world and we see people divided into different religions. But the Islam, as brother has said, in its name, it has the word peace itself.
Yes.
And according to one meaning, we refer to the religion of peace. Therefore, Islam has a big contribution in order to make a peace. And obviously, it depends whether we follow the Islam in its true way or not. Because everything has two kinds of use. It can be used properly or it can be misused. So when we talk about the religion of Islam and its contribution towards the peace in the world, we can see that the Islam is the complete version of all the religions.
Okay.
And it has everything within it. And because it's the final religion, we can say like from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
Therefore, it also refers to the peace as well. And on top of that, we, you know, the slogans even in the Quran and that are given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, these are not general or general slogans. For example, when he talks about his prophet, he wants to introduce his prophet, he says he's Rahmatul Lil Alameen.
Yes.
He's the mercy for all the worlds. So the one who's mercy for all the worlds means that he is the bringer of peace to all the worlds, basically.
That's right.
So when we talk about the worlds, obviously it's different
yes.
states.
Okay.
So we can say like Islam has a big contribution if we really follow the true Islam.
That's right.
Because nowadays the problem is that the enemies are propagating against Islam
yes.
and people do not know the real source
yes.
of the Islam.
That's right. But say, Murtaza, there are still some doubts and questions regarding the misunderstanding out of the religion of Islam, because the extremist groups who are really the pioneers of showing a kind of violent, barbaric picture of Islam to the world, refer to the same text of the Holy Quran that calls Prophet Muhammad as Rahmatul Lil Alameen. But they understood it in this way to kill here and there, to commit suicide, you know, and such, you know, violent actions that are every day shown on the Western media, on the news, you know, here and there. You can find you know, so many clips, video clips, the audios here and there. And that's why even some of the scholars of religions in the world at the universities believe that these violent things are based on the very text of the Quran and the context in which Islam was created. What's your answer to that?
Well, actually, let's look at the wrong misinterpretation of some verses of the Holy Quran. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, some people that you call them scholars, they have their own interpretations, which has no actually base and roots in Islamic principles and ideologies. And unfortunately, we have this idea that the religious leaders who have a very crucial role in bringing peace into communities, I think it's highly important to know, and it's really good to know that we all have a very important task to establish peace mm-hmm. among all communities. This part has been forgotten by these people that they are just by name scholars.
Okay.
And unfortunately, they are not very much involved in interpreting the true aspects of some verses of the Holy Quran.
Okay.
So these pictures that have been you know, broadcasted around the world are just coming from those interpretations that are not true. So if, on the other hand, we have another downside of this issue that many scholars do not get themselves involved in providing the true interpretation of those verses and give them the information and give such information to those who are going to fight in order to bring peace, not to bring conflicts.
That's right.
So some fighting is not all about creating conflicts. People sometimes are dragged into fighting. I can call them not fight jihad because they want to bring peace. Unfortunately, this is not been interpreted correctly.
That's right. This interpretation of the verses of the Quran, and you know, the thing is that they delete some part and they add some part to the verses of the Holy Quran. The context in which that verse was revealed is not known to them. And if you look at the history and how much the religion of Islam could help establishing peace among the families and the societies on the Arab Peninsula at the time of Prophet Muhammad, you know, it would be really beautiful from the side of the scholars. But Sayyid Mohsen, you know, still, as I said, there are some commentaries written on the verses of the Holy Quran and the incidents, especially after the demise of the Prophet Muhammad, about the wars that took place by the Muslim leaders and the kings here and there in different lands of the societies, show that maybe Islam was spread by sword and not words. What's your answer to that, brother?
Well, the problem started right after the demise of the Prophet.
Okay.
And for your previous and the recent question which you asked, for both of them, the answer is that the main root of this diversion and this extremism that which we see like in today's world, it's because right after the demise of Prophet, there were some people who said, Hasbuna kitab Allah. The book of Allah is enough for us. Mm-hmm. Whereas the book of Allah brings the overall or general rules and the detailed rules, and the details are in the life of the Prophet, in the narrations of the Prophet. So when they left the sunnah of the Prophet and the, we can say, the narrations of the Prophet, and they just attach, and they got the book only, yes, which they couldn't even understand, because the book of Allah, Quran, has in its verses there are some hidden meanings.
Yes.
There are some clear wordings. There are some mutashabih, like there are some similar, yes, things that, which are said. There are some clear, I said, like
the muhkamat, mutashabihat
have, yes, different meanings, obviously, as well. But obviously, there is nasakh and mansukh. There was a rule, and later by the Prophet, yes, it was overruled, and then the new rule, right, came. So when we look at the Quran, it has different aspects. In, mm-hmm, order to understand the Quran, we need to refer back to the history of the revelation.
That's right.
Like why this verse was revealed,
okay,
upon the Prophet.
Yes.
Because of whom? What happened? Who did what? So that the Prophet has, yes, said this, or Allah has revealed the, yes, verses. So when they left all these things, these details, and they just got the book, yes, on its own without the teacher, without the explanation which was given by the Prophet,
yes,
we can see all those issues that happened into the Islam. And the picture today that, yes, we have, that Islam is spread by the sword,
yes,
this was never happened in the life of Prophet.
Yes.
Prophet never invaded any place.
Yes.
Rather, the battles which he had, it was in defense of Islam. He was defending the Muslims.
Yes.
And at that time, yes, it is true that it was out of the Medina. Why? Because at that time, whenever there used to be a battle, they used to go at a common place.
That's all right.
Which was in the middle of like, okay, two countries or two places.
Okay.
So this was the reason, basically. That's so right. The main reason is when some people left the sayings of the Prophet, Ahlul Bayt, alayhimus salam, which were obviously, yes, Allah has also emphasized, okay, on this, and the Prophet also said, I'm leaving amongst you two things, the Quran and Ahlul Bayt.
Mm-hmm.
So when they just got the Quran and they left Ahlul Bayt, they left the sayings of the Prophet narrations, the explanations, okay, about the verses, that's what happens generally.
Okay.
And this wrong picture that today we have is because of,
yes, that's right,
leaving the explanations given, yes, by the Prophet.
And the Ahlul Bayt also as the true exegesis of the Holy Quran. But in the 21st century, still after 14 centuries, after the relation of the Holy Quran to Prophet Muhammad and Islam, how do you think, Sayyid Murtaza, Islam and its teachings, its true teachings, I would like to very much use this term, pure Muhammadan Islam's teachings, you know, can help international bodies like these different international bodies that are working for peace, you know? Whenever you look at the main slogans and the mottos of these organizations, you can find peace. How Islam can help them in today's world?
You know, let's look at this question from another point of view.
Okay.
So all religions, including the religion of Islam, to some extent came, and it was descended to prophets to bring peace and bring nations together. So it is a duty we all have. And this has been bestowed upon us,
yes,
that we must work very hard to teach and influence on each and every community on the earth in order to live a peaceful life and to be a follower of this peaceful life. So the religion of Islam has put a great emphasis on this aspect.
Okay.
And if you can see, wherever we have gatherings, meetings, the first thing that is been mentioned by the speakers and those leaders, especially religious leaders, is the unity.
Yes.
So when we talk about unity and the United Nation, so it means that Islam is putting its greatest slogan and mottos on unity. So unity is not happening without understanding, without mutual understanding, especially about religious matters.
That's right.
So the religion of Islam is focusing on similarities.
That's right.
The differences are not going to be given the first priority.
Okay.
So similarities bring people together.
Right.
So this aspect is the one that Islam has been propagated and has been talked about this matter over centuries.
That's all right. Especially as you said, reaching a kind of common ground among the Islamic leaders between themselves and also the leaders of the other religious communities and being united is a really important one. You know, the meetings that are happening today and the dialogue, both interfaith and intrafaith dialogues that are taking place and established in today's world show that all religious leaders are after making this peace in the world and not the conflict. But unfortunately, this media and the power of the media is showing it the way around.
And of course, you know that we need to work in order to build relationships.
Yes.
And relations of trust, with other religions.
Yes.
And this is what Islam has been always doing. Over the past centuries, we had our infallible imams,
yes.
Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And on top of all, we have the Book of Islam, Quran, is telling us and its followers that a amicable relationship with other religions and with other followers of the other religions is really of a great importance.
That's all right.
So this shows that Islam has already said clearly that peace with and to other nations and anyone is very important.
That's all right. Said Mohsen, thank you very much, brothers, for your presence in the program. Viewpoints regarding how the religion of Islam can establish peace in today's world. It was very kind of you. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, view our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye. A symphony of nature. It's taking my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/EN.
in the limelight.
U.S. officials claim the military aims for net zero carbon emissions by 2050, but with a carbon footprint greater than some 140 countries, critics say it needs radical change. We're prepared for you an article written by Ife Kuchliu. The piece is titled, "Is Superpolluting Pentagon's Climate Plan Just Military-Grade Greenwash?" U.S. military, an institution whose carbon footprint exceeds that of nearly 140 countries, claims it wants to go green. On 8th of February this year, the U.S. Army released its climate strategy. Among other tactics, officials claim the Army aims for net zero emissions by 2050, to electrify its combat and non-tactical vehicles, to power its bases with carbon-free electricity, and to develop clean global supply chains. Wars are extreme polluters, and while the Army's purported plan would significantly reduce its greenhouse gas emissions, experts say it does not do nearly enough. David Vine, a professor of political anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C., said, "The Department of Defense, the entity that is the U.S. war machine, is the largest institutional contributor to global warming on planet Earth." Professor David Vine added, "And the military does not acknowledge that. It does at least state that there is a need to reduce its impact on the planet. For example, the Army Climate Strategy admits that the U.S. Army's nearly $740 million yearly expenditure on electricity created 4.1 million tons of greenhouse gases in 2020, 1 million tons more than the greenhouse gas emissions generated by Switzerland's heat and electricity sector in 2017. Although the U.S. Army's climate strategy is reflective of the Pentagon's stance on the climate crisis, which it has identified as a security threat, critics say the plan misses out on several crucial details. Doug Weir, research and policy director at the Conflict and Environment Observatory, said, "It lacks accountability mechanisms, for one thing," adding, "We need to ensure that scrutiny mechanisms are in place, otherwise it's just military-grade greenwash." For example, the U.S. military and the U.S. Army do not report their fuel usage to Congress, let alone itemize how much fuel was spent where or on what war. Most U.S. government accounting of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions omit figures on how much the military contributes, even by a relatively easy-to-track measure like fuel consumption. And consume fuel it certainly does in vast quantities. A 2019 report found that the Department of Defense is not only the largest consumer of energy in the United States, but is also the world's largest institutional consumer of petroleum, and thus the world's largest institutional emitter of greenhouse gases. Between 2001 and 2017, the Department of Defense was responsible for emitting 1.2 billion metric tons of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, equivalent to the annual emissions of 257 million cars. This year, it is expected to burn through 82.3 million barrels of fuel, more than the total oil consumption of Finland. Netta Crawford, political scientist and co-director of Brown University's Costs of War project, said, The plan aims to supposedly reduce this number, but a more impactful way for the US military to address the scale and pace of its carbon footprint is to simply do less. She points to the fact that the US military has about 800 installations in 80 countries and another 740 military bases on home soil, of which about 315 are army installations. Yet by its own admission, the Pentagon says the US Army operates a third more bases than it needs. It calls this excess basing capacity. Professor David Vine said far greater savings can be achieved by just closing a base rather than making a base that is unnecessary more energy efficient. Even that kind of thinking would probably not be enough to reduce the armed forces' greenhouse gas emissions as much as is needed, however. Stephen Smith, coordinator at the UN Environment Programme's Disasters and Conflict subprogramme, said the military's climate impact is not just about the environmental footprint of the military itself, it's also about the way the operations are conducted and the way wars are fought. Stephen Smith added, "War is, by its nature, destructive." For instance, post-war construction uses up a vast amount of resources. According to Hassan Parto, a UN Environment Program Manager, the disposal of rubble and rebuilding from infrastructure destruction is a long, carbon-intensive process. Referring to cleanups that were required in Iraq, Hassan Parto said, "The amount of trucking and emissions that would be required to dispose of this debris is like traveling from the Earth to the Moon multiple times." War also degrades land, altering and reducing its carbon sequestration capacity. Ware said, "The land degradation legacy in Iraq shows that when you change the land and change the soils, that changes the amount of carbon it can store. To what extent is unclear, as it is rarely, if ever, studied. But soil erosion causes carbon loss, and desertification and degradation reduce land's ability to hold carbon, all of which probably happened in Iraq, particularly in what was once marshland." Weir said, "We know so little about how much land is destroyed in this matter," adding, "No one's really following or documenting it." He thinks an even larger contributor to the climate crisis than the emissions caused by fighting is the environmental changes those conflicts create. Of course, the fighting doesn't help. Hassan Parto says some of the first targets in conflict zones are oil infrastructure and electricity-generating power plants. The US military has frequently targeted oil tankers in Syria. The resulting fires give rise to heavy carbon emissions. Hassan Parto added, "In the case of Iraq, people could not see the sun from all the emissions. US emissions rose dramatically following the wars in both Iraq and Afghanistan." But even non-violent conflict triggers other carbon emissions. Netta Crawford, political scientist and co-director of Brown University's Cost of War Project, said, "When the United States acts to increase its presence in Asia and the Pacific, it alerts the Chinese to the American presence, and they respond by making more weapons, which in turn produce more carbon emissions. But what can be done, rather than only see the climate emergency as a security threat that needs to be trained for?" Netta Crawford suggests the US military should help reduce the emergency itself and the instability it will cause. Netta Crawford said a much better strategy than preparing for climate change-caused war is to prevent climate change-caused war. According to Lindsay Kushgarian, Program Director at the National Priorities Project, federal and military budgeting priorities might also need to shift. The White House is expected to request a military budget of more than $770 billion for the next fiscal year. Lindsay Kushgarian added, as long as we continue to push that amount of money into the military, we will not have the resources to deal with climate change. Even so, the U.S. Army Climate Strategy is considered an important document. Professor David Vine says it does reflect a long-standing concern in the U.S. military that actually has been much more progressive and advanced than most of the rest of the U.S. government about global warming and climate change. Netta Crawford added, for example, the move to electrify army vehicles is significant in the stimulus it gives to manufacturers to produce more electric vehicles and lower their costs in the rest of the country. Richard Kidd, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Environment and Energy Resilience, claimed the Department of Defense will incorporate climate risks in its future strategies as well, including the expected National Defense Strategy, adding, a comprehensive climate mitigation and sustainability plan will be released in the fall. However, the concern remains that these strategies will only treat the symptoms and not marginally. Although the Army Climate Strategy, ACS, highlights the need to act now, it says so four times in the document. The targets are set over another 20 years. To Lindsay Kushgarian, plans like the Army Climate Strategy prompt a bigger question. Can any military goal, such as sustained land dominance by any large military, America's or otherwise, ever be sustainable? Kushgarian notes that there is no such thing as sustainable fast fashion, and there's no such thing as sustainable global military hegemony.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.